In just a moment, Keys to the Capitol. But first, here's a word about an outstanding NBC News feature you'll hear this Saturday evening. It's Heart of the News. Heart of the News is the widely acclaimed program that explores today's top issues completely and thoroughly. The program that takes you behind the headlines, tells you the entire story of a single top news item. You'll hear analysis by the experts. You'll get a look at tomorrow's headlines. In short, you'll hear the heart of the news. It's more reporting at its best by the NBC News staff. Be on hand this Saturday for NBC's top-rated 30-minute news highlight, Heart of the News. And now stay tuned for Keys to the Capitol on NBC.
What's going on in Washington?
Are we going to blockade Red China?
The next move in foreign policy may be peaceful coexistence with competition.
Alger Hiss and the end of an era.
And the Democrats get ready for 56.
NBC News brings you Keys to the Capitol, a transcribed program of informal discussion by NBC, Washington reporters and commentators on issues and measures. NBC News has given these correspondents the assignment of taking you with them behind official doors where opinions are formed and policies are formulated. Tonight you will hear Leif Eade, Richard Harkness, Roger Kennedy, and Ray Scherer in an exchange of fact and opinion on controversies and problems current in national affairs. Listen now to Keys to the Capitol. First, here is NBC Washington correspondent Leif Eade.
You know, this blockade business that Senator Noland has brought up, as far as I know, Noland has never explained to the people just what his blockade would involve, what a blockade actually is. Neither Secretary Dulles nor President Eisenhower, except to say that a blockade of the China coast would be a war action, and they're against it, for now, anyway. As a matter of fact, you find it pretty difficult to find out any place around town what a blockade is, who and what it would involve, and all the legal implications. But the formal definition seemed to agree with the President and Dulles. You find one, for instance, that says a blockade is an act of war carried on by the warships of a belligerent detailed to prevent access to or departure from a definite part of the enemy's coast. If that doesn't sound like war, I'd like to know what would. Then you go on and find out that it's designed to cause the enemy to surrender or come to terms by cutting off all commercial intercourse by sea. Even the definition of what they call a Pacific blockade, a peaceful blockade, or a method of coercion short of war, may be regarded as an act of war by a power strong enough to resist. Now then, it doesn't stop there. When you blockade a coast, say the coast of Red China, you don't only stop the traffic of the Red Chinese vessels of commerce, you stop everybody else's ships, too. So a blockade would involve not only this country and Red China, it would involve the ships of, say, Britain and France and all other technically neutral countries in this scrap, including the merchant ships of those Asian countries, the ones in Southeast Asia, that we're trying to win over, but who feel that they have to trade with Red China to live. So you can see, if you declare a blockade and make it effective, and remember that it has to be effective, not just a paper blockade, or it won't be recognized by other nations at all, why then you're taking an action that involves most of the nations of the world. On another point, that consideration of a paper blockade, which is not legally recognized by other nations, you would guess that any effective blockade of Red China would involve a sizable part of the United States Navy with its entire Air Force. I don't know how you fellows feel about it, but I was a little amazed when I started looking into even these simple facts about a blockade. What do you think about it?
Well, Leif, one thing struck me just as you were talking along there, that during the war in Korea, after the Chinese communists came in, the question of blockading Red China came up as a very real problem, not a hypothetical problem, but a very real problem before the Joint Chiefs of Staff under General Omar Bradley. We at the time were not at war officially or formally with Communist China. The Joint Chiefs rejected this idea of blockading Red China when there was that very real reason on two grounds. First, right in agreement with your definition that a blockade was an act of war, then we should be prepared to go to war with Red China whole hog if we tried to blockade the communists. And two, there was some question, too, about the efficiency of a blockade. Mm. As I recall, I haven't checked on it recently, but I think these figures are roughly correct, that the experts came up with the estimate that it would be about 2 years of blockade before the Chinese would be really pinched. And on those two grounds, the Joint Chiefs of Staff again in the context of fighting the Red Chinese in Korea, gave up the idea of a blockade.
Didn't they say that the Red Chinese were only dependent about 25% on waterborne traffic and about 75% of their supplies came overland?
That's right, yeah. Because the Russians have done a great deal to improve that transportation system, and the bulk. I think that 75% figure is probably about right. Three-quarters of their trade supplies come from Russia or the other communist satellites by way of Russia. Mm-hmm. For instance, Czechoslovak arms never go by waterways, would never come under our blockade.
Yeah.
So that even if you could set up an effective sea blockade of Red China, it would not materially affect their supplies.
It would
take time. Is that the point?
It would take time.
Perhaps even that's even assuming the present setup and with the Russians and the Chinese completing their new railroad to supplement the goods that can come across the Manchurian Railroad, it would presumably become even less effective in the future.
Yeah, well, of course, the Chinese have never been terribly dependent on railroads anyway.
They eat camels and coolies.
That's right. Look, another point there which may be just sort of historically interesting. For almost 10 years, the Chinese communists seemed to get along all right without any outside help when they were fighting the Kuomintang and the Japanese. And presumably, they may be able to continue with just overt Russian help.
I suppose they're more vulnerable now because they're responsible for the people in the seaport towns who need rice. They need rubber for their industry.
They're trying to expand and develop economically and industrially. Mm-hmm. So they are more vulnerable now than they were back in those formative days. And, of course, going back to this historical point, the communists largely fought Chiang Kai-shek with some American lend-lease goods, if I recall, that they captured.
They do, too, also, of course, have access to far greater raw materials than they had before. They were up in a pretty inaccessible and barren part of the country. Now they've got at least access to the rice bowl in northern Vietnam, and they have access to all of the raw materials formerly under the nationalist control. I wonder whether maybe another question we might ask about this is who's going to get hurt worse, our allies, our side, or their side by such a blockade? Who profits most from such a blockade?
That's an open question because, say, for instance, Ceylon, which is a pretty good friend of ours, has to send burlap bags and a lot of other stuff up to Red China so that they can get some food back to feed their people.
Mm-hmm.
Then there's all that rubber that keeps piling up in Malaya. They've got an outlet for some of it there. We have quit buying a tremendous... we've quit stockpiling it. Our shortages are over.
Well, getting back to Senator Nolan, who started this whole talk about the blockade, as I read the senator, he isn't so much concerned about whether or not a blockade is efficient as doing something, making some show of force to spring loose these 13 Americans.
Oh, wouldn't it be worse if the blockade were a fizzle? You'd have to make it effective.
Wouldn't we lose far more by making it ineffective?
I'll grant all that, but I say what he is concerned
You've got to be
about.
Prepared to throw in the whole Navy and maybe a couple of divisions of Marines.
You certainly do. Once you start the blockade, it better stick or you've lost.
Not only in Asia, you've lost among your own allies.
I rather doubt that Senator Nolan started this blockade talk. It originated, actually, with this new Joint Chiefs of Staff.
General, it goes clear back to General MacArthur, as you pointed out.
Yes, and more recently to Admiral Radford, the present chairman of the Joint Chiefs, who has had that long Pacific experience, and it's not experience to be tossed over lightly, and for us to just sit here and say the blockade won't work, because Admiral Radford, I'm sure, knows his business. He's been in it a long time, and he knows the Pacific very well. But basically, the first idea for a blockade came from within the Joint Chiefs of Staff, and if we get our gossip correctly, the Joint Chiefs of Staff stand 3-1 in favor of a blockade, with only General Ridgway, Chief of Staff of the Army, opposed to it. So it's a very real problem.
And President Eisenhower.
And President Eisenhower, most importantly, of course.
Well, the question I'd like to raise is this. Why did the Chinese communists suddenly go on the radio last week and announce that they had sentenced the 13 Americans to prison? What was the motive? It was trumped up, to be sure, but why did they trump it up?
Everyone only knows why they did. They obviously had a motive in it, because Joe Enlai is not a dumb bunny. He knows his way around. He's supposed to be one of the smartest guys there.
How about just domestic consumption, trying to divert attention from troubles at home to the strength and the importance of this new government abroad? showing how tough they are with the Americans. Does that make
sense?
Yeah,
but they've been doing that for a long time before. Why particularly now?
Here's another factor that came to light today. As you know, they refused to talk to us about it, and some people suspect that maybe they're trying to maneuver themselves, going about it very badly, to be sure, but trying to get themselves into a position where they have got to be admitted to the United Nations, so we will have a channel to discuss things like this with them. As it is, we have no diplomatic channels with the Chinese Reds. And when we do want to talk Turkey over something like these 13 Americans, they thumb their big red nose at us.
I doubt that they can shoot their way in yet.
Well, as I say, they're going about it badly, but...
The result is going to be exactly the opposite.
The reverse.
Right along this line, we've been talking. It looks very much today, I think, that Senator Nolan, to the contrary, and his name's come up, that the administration is moving toward what may prove to be peaceful coexistence. That is, that we live side by side with the communists in this world, and then compete peaceably for friends and allies. Now, one cannot pinpoint this development too specifically at this time. It hasn't cleared the Budget Bureau. The Treasury is yet to be heard from. But what we've seen so far comes about this way. Now, we all know about the post-war Marshall Plan in Western Europe, a plan that was a great success by any standard. We enabled Western Europe to recoup, to rehabilitate, and stand up not only against military, but equally important, against political aggression from the East. Now, in following the Marshall Plan, there's some really striking figures. For instance, we here in the United States produce what we call a gross national product. That's everything we make, all the services we perform. We produce this gross national product of a $350 billion a year, a really startling figure. Now, Western Europe, built up under the Marshall Plan, has now come up to a level of $250 billion. Now, that compares to $160 billion gross national product by all of Russia, by the entire satellite bloc, including Red China. Then here's another striking figure. Take all the people in Asia, barring, of course, Red China. Their product is only $75 billion. Now, that leads to what apparently is a basic decision in part of the branch of the government. That is that we take this money now that we've been spending abroad for military and economic aid, and launch what amounts to a pre-world Marshall Plan-type program for Asia. This program, as I understand it, would take in a great circle in Asia, Korea, Japan, and dropping down Philippines, Southeastern Asia, India, and on around to Afghanistan. Now, the United States, under this program, would spend billions, let's say in the neighborhood of $2 billion a year for perhaps up to 8 years, to give Asia steel plants, fertilizer plants, hydroelectric projects, to raise the standard of living on a long-term permanent basis and thus give the Asiatics a reason for standing up to communism. Now, of course, there are many, many problems and complex problems entailed here. For instance, will our free world allies join, and on what basis will they put up some money too? Will it be a largely loan program where we can stand to get our money back, or will it be largely grants? And of course, there's the very real question, certainly in the Budget Bureau and the Treasury, how much can the United States afford? Because it would knock the budget clear out of balance. But the main point, that this program, even discussion of it, is based on one definite premise, gentlemen, and that is a premise of no war at all. Maybe local wars, but no global wars. It's based on the premise, then, of peaceful coexistence with the communists. Peaceful coexistence in which we compete with communism in what our two ideologies can do for people.
You know, that goes right back to an idea that Eric Johnson put out shortly after the war, when he was testifying up here on the Hill. I remember one day he was saying, well, we shouldn't be afraid of competing with the communism and see which could do the best job for the whole world.
Mm-hmm.
And it really comes down to that.
Yes,
and we don't have much choice, as a matter of fact.
No.
If the Russians don't choose not to shoot, then this is the competition we take, or else we're out of the race.
As I understand this plan, it's based on this sort of general premise, that the communists go into a country, infiltrate, take it over. Then they take their capital development literally out of the hides of
mm-hmm.
the people.
Mm-hmm.
They build a hydroelectric project by the sweat of slave labor. We do it by putting in capital investment, by spending money, by hiring people to do it. And the communists do it their way, that it's up to us then, if we're going to hold Asia on our side, that we must do it our way. It's possible that this thing would not cost us more money in total. I think the current mutual security appropriation runs about $2.7 billion. There are heavy appropriations in there for military as well as economic aid. that the Federal Operations Administration probably could shift over to this Asiatic Marshall Plan type program and still keep below the current $2.7 billion figure.
Dick, don't you think that the military aid thing, which is appealing to Congress particularly, is just about outrun its usefulness?
No, I don't think it's outrun its usefulness, Lee.
I mean, its acceptance among those peoples of Southeast Asia.
Well, I don't know. I can only go by Western Europe, which we know
about.
Well,
yeah, it's different.
We rebuilt the Western Europeans to an economic point where they now can take over their own defense spending,
don't you see? But you run into a case like India, and no plan is worth anything if you don't get India on your side. If you don't get India on your side, you're sunk. And they don't want any military aid.
No, but you've got the double problem in most of Asia that you have not only to give them military aid, that you have to do more than rehabilitate an economic plant. You've got to give them a brand new.
You've got to build an economic plant.
You've got to start from scratch. It's a much tougher problem than Western Europe.
Sure. Dick, I'd like to ask you this question. How far along is this thing? Is this just a plan they have? Has Mr. Sasson been sending up trial balloons, or is this something that the whole administration is ready to go on? What stage is it in now?
Well, I think you can follow a rather definite pattern here. The other night in his speech from Chicago, the Secretary of State, Mr. Dulles, had a passing reference to such a program. And then the next day, out comes the program in rather full, yet broad detail. I would say from that one branch of the administration, the State Department, the Foreign Operations Administration, are for this. That I'm told, too, that President Eisenhower will have definitely some figures for this program in his January budget and then follow it up with a mutual security special message to Congress in February or March. It's gotten along that far.
I think it goes back a long way, because I remember a friend of mine coming down from Boston, I think it was, with Sherman Adams, and he was saying about a year ago that he figured that this arms aid had gone just about as far as it goes. It'd have to go back to economic.
But let's don't get away from the point that basically this means peaceful coexistence. Yeah. That's the most important thing as of now.
Well, here's another aspect of this peaceful coexistence business. It seems to me that we ought to maybe discuss what's going to happen about in our internal security problem from here on out. Perhaps the combination of events this week may serve to mark off a period which is past from one which now seems to be beginning in this area. The two principal figures of the time when our internal security was the chief concern of our legislative investigators came back into the news. Alger Hiss was released from Lewisburg Federal Penitentiary, and William Remington died there under circumstances which are certainly not yet explained. Both of these men were sent to Lewisburg on convictions for perjury, for lying when they denied connections with communist spy rings. But more than that, the prosecution of both was begun by congressional committees engaged in weeding out suspected subversives from the government. Now, it seems to me that many things have happened since these men went to prison which have marked off this time for that. When William Remington and Alger Hiss went into the government service, the world was not divided into halves dominated by the Soviet Union and ourselves competitively coexisting. Internal security meant primarily security from fascist, not communist espionage and sabotage. Then after World War II came that sudden estrangement between the victors, and we suddenly had to develop machinery and techniques for dealing with the internal communist menace. Congress passed a group of unprecedented laws, and congressional committees moved into this area in ways which were unique. They began to act more like grand juries than as fact-finding groups, and new names like McCarthy and McCarran, Jenner and Valdi came into the headlines. Alger Hiss and William Remington were convicted. The FBI doubled and trebled in size. The Department of Justice began to develop new expert attorneys in internal security cases. But today, it seems to me the situation is fundamentally changed. The Justice Department now has a core of men who are experienced and well-equipped to handle internal security cases, grouped in a whole new division under a tough, able Assistant Attorney General. The entire process of hiring and promotion in the government has been alerted, some say over-alerted, for possible security risks, and all employees are screened over and over again. And at the same time, now here's a question I want to put to you all. Is it fair to say that at the same time these days, the congressional committees are much less active in this area? Maybe it's because they're busier elsewhere, but it seems to me that maybe it's because today it's become pretty obvious that the government, the administration itself,
can well handle its own security program. How about that?
Well, I don't think he's going to find the congressmen and senators letting this lush area go.
What do you think?
Untouched.
But don't you think you can see, though, it's going to be a matter of rampaging than it used to be anyway?
Because there aren't so many people to rampage for.
Yeah, the law of diminishing returns is about the only reason that they'd run up.
Well,
but they say one after another says it, that we're not going to keep hands off this.
No, but the security program is so much tighter.
Sure
than it was. And, perhaps, as you say, there are less
that
to catch.
That puts more premium on the one that you do get.
I think I'd have to answer that question in the negative, too. Right now, we've had sort of a lull. Two of the most publicized communist hunters were Senator Pat McCarran, he just died, and Senator McCarthy, who has been otherwise engaged these last several months on investigations in which he figured himself. I think the committees of Congress are going to keep going after communists. Senator McClellan, who now becomes chairman of the McCarthy Committee, announced at first that he was considering setting up a joint Senate and House committee. And that he thought his government operations committee, the McCarthy Committee, had no business going into communism. Senator McClellan has changed his mind. Well, he has now said that his committee will look into the communist problem. You're going to have an investigation of the government's security program by the Democrats. I think the Justice Department probably will have a case ready to pop about that time. It's going to be right in the field of congressional investigations and congressional politics.
And Dick, don't you think that the Democrats, along with this, have got to prove that they're just as tough or maybe a little bit tougher on Reds in the government than the Republicans
are?
They will be running the two, investigating the Eisenhower security program and still looking for Reds at the same time.
Under the Democratic administration, Mr. Truman and his Justice Department took the position with Congress, let us do the job. We'll clean out the communists.
So did now, President Eisenhower.
Now, here is the Republican administration comes along and the Justice Department says, we're built up, let us take care of it. Congress, don't you mind? Well, Congress is certainly going to mind.
Well, now you got Francis Walter, who will be running Mr. Velde's committee, saying that he favors dismissing that committee and merging its functions with the House Judiciary Committee. Seems to me that all this is true. It's not going to be out of the area of politics, but it seems to me it will be much less in the area of politics than it has been, simply because there will be less to find.
Here's what we'll do. I'll meet you here in this studio 1 year from today, and I'll bring the newspaper headlines from the congressional investigation.
You're on, Dick. Well, I think that's a fair
way to prove it.
Well, while you gentlemen have been wrestling with all sorts of cosmic problems in our discussion here and planning to meet each other 1 year from now, I'd like to take up something closer to home, a big problem that concerns the Democratic Party. In fact, one that comes to a head this weekend. The Democrats are having a big powwow down in New Orleans December 3rd and 4th. NBC, in fact, is sending me down there to cover it. They're going to discuss, quote, how we won in 54 and how we can win again in 56. But more important, they're going to pick, at least they're going to try, to pick a new chairman. Steve Mitchell has been holding the job since Adlai Stevenson handpicked him after the convention nomination 2 years ago. Some of the Democrats haven't been too friendly with Mitchell, but at the moment, most of them concede he's done a pretty good job. The point is, Mitchell wants out. And the trick in choosing his successor is picking a man mutually satisfactory to all wings of the party, to both Harry Truman and Adlai Stevenson. The Democrats thought they had such a man in Tom Finletter, former Secretary of the Air Force, a high-class man who would have lent tone to the job. He was okay with both Truman and Stevenson, we're told. But Finletter said no. Now, Steve Mitchell is pushing his friend Paul Butler from Indiana. But the talk is that former chairman Frank McKinney, a Truman man, also from Indiana, doesn't get on with Butler. A possible compromise choice is Jim Finnegan, the Democratic leader in Philadelphia. And there are plenty of other candidates, Mike DeSalle, the Price Administrator, Senator Clements of Kentucky, plenty of candidates. Now, you say, why is it so important, this choice of a Democratic national chairman? Well, for one thing, the job involves all kinds of political contacts. It pays $20,000 a year. Most important, it seems to me, is that the chairman will have a good deal to say whether Adlai Stevenson is the presidential candidate again 2 years from now. That's the point to watch. I think most people suspect Adlai wants it. What do you think about all this, Leif? Who's your candidate for Democratic chairman?
Gee, I haven't got any.
You're not going down to New Orleans,
I'm,
too?
No, I'm not going down to New Orleans to cast any votes or doing any lobbying either.
Do you think Stevenson would run again if he knew that if he knew definitely that Ike was going to be a candidate, Dick? How about that?
Sure.
Would run again? Man, he's running.
Whose man is Mr. Finnegan?
Mr. Finnegan seems to be a sort of a compromise choice. He's been very successful in Philadelphia in putting the Democrats back on their feet. Mm-hmm. His health isn't too good, and that's one of the factors.
What I was curious about, Ray, is there a Symington man in the running, or is there a whoever else a man in the running here? Is there competition, but a Kefauver man? Is there competition here between representatives of the various possibles?
There's a lot of smoke-filled room stuff going on, and another man who's going to have a big say in the chairman, of course, is Sam Rayburn, probably the biggest Democrat in Washington.
Mm. He isn't going to run for president, couldn't get a better chairman either, may I say, than
Congressman Speaker Rayburn.
Well, he's not a candidate, of course, but he'll certainly have a lot to say about who is the candidate.
Well, you haven't mentioned one man who intrigues me very much, and that's a man named Averill Harriman. Of course, right after he was elected governor, Harriman came out and said he was for Stevenson in 56. Mr. Truman said he's for Stevenson in 56. If it's also Pat, why go through that?
Why isn't the argument?
Well, there's an anti-Stevenson wing in the party, which might want to displace any chairman.
I think maybe you've overlooked perhaps the most important voice in this meeting at New Orleans, and that is this block of Southern governors, Governor James F. Burns, to name one, the group which is still rankled and nettled over that loyalty oath fight at the Chicago Convention in 52. Rather than a fight between the Harriman people and the Stevenson people and the Truman people, could very well simmer down into a political tug of war between the Northern liberal and the Southern conservative wings of the Democratic Party. If that happens, I think they might even defer the choice of a chairman for 60 or 90 days while the distinguished statesmen retire to the back room and talk it over. Or they may come on some compromise man like, you mentioned what, Senator Clemens.
Clemens would be a good compromise choice.
Who would be Mike a fine Sal, compromise? Maybe. Oh, no.
He's liberal. Not as much as Clemens.
No, Clemens, a border state man. He's very popular in Congress. He's a Democratic whip of the Senate already. I haven't seen a man who's come along in national politics
He's been endorsed by Alan Shivers down in Kentucky, which doesn't set too well with a lot of the Democrats.
Alan Shivers, Kentucky, Texas?
Texas.
Well, that's another question that they've got to consider.
Right now, it seems to me that the two wings of the... Jimmy Burns, to the contrary, notwithstanding, the two wings of the Democratic Party, North and South, are getting along pretty well.
And they hope to perpetuate the thing.
Probably Lyndon Johnson's work.
They were fighting pretty hard about Mitchell and Adlai Stevenson, but it seems to me that here lately they haven't been fighting as much.
No, there are no plums.
Well, there are no plums, I know, but that never stopped a couple of Democrats from fighting before.
You don't fight plums years in the future. You don't fight normally when you're the outs. The Republicans, usually do the battling. Yeah. Now the Democrats are coming back into Congress. They see 1956, and
you remember that the Republicans had a dandy scrap when they were on the Oz, too, out here in Omaha. Remember when they were sticking the knife into Scott?
Well, yes. That was the liberal-conservative fight, and I think that's what the Democratic Party's based on.
It's obvious that both sides are trying to find a compromise man who is acceptable.
All of which should make for an interesting couple of days down there in New Orleans.
Isn't it nice to get away from the big, surly facts of the world down here where it's fun again?
You have been listening to Keys to the Capitol, brought to you transcribed by NBC News as a way of taking you behind the doors of official Washington with NBC's top reporters and commentators. Tonight, you heard Ray Shearer, Roger Kennedy, Richard Harkness, and Lee Feeb. Keys to the Capitol will be brought to you at this same time each week. This is the NBC Radio Network.